Support for this podcast comes from the UTSA Institute of Texan Cultures, hosting the Asian Festival, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. February 1st. It's a day of hands-on activities for kids and families with music, dance, martial arts demonstrations, food vendors preparing authentic Asian dishes, a gallery of bonsai trees, and other attractions. Details and ticket info at asianfestivalsa.com.
You're listening to The Source. I'm David Martin Davies. Before Black Lives Matter, before the presidential election of Barack Obama, before Jesse Jackson's run for the presidency, there was the original Rainbow Coalition in Chicago in the late 1960s. This was the coming together of Black, white, and Puerto Rican activists fighting to improve living conditions and against abuse of a police force there. The story is told in a new documentary called The First Rainbow Coalition. It airs on PBS's Independent Lens, and the director joins me. It's San Antonio's Ray Santisteban. All right, Ray, welcome to The Source. It's good to have you here.
Thank you. Thanks for the invitation.
Okay, and we're going to play a little clip from the film of the Rainbow Coalition.
This here is the Rainbow Coalition button, and there's white, brown, yellow, red, and black. Didn't matter what color you wore this with pride.
The Rainbow Coalition was about uniting communities so that we can make revolutionary change. Our communities were all struggling for the same cause. In unity, there was force.
Urban Southern whites with Puerto Ricans and blacks. I don't think there had ever been anything that substantial in any urban environment.
What was going on in your neighborhood? The same thing was going on in my neighborhood. You know? And how are you going to change that? You ain't going to change it by hating the people in the other neighborhood. But the fastest way to change that was for those neighborhoods to come together.
Housing issues, police brutality, just being fed up. That's what we could all agree on.
Ray, the idea of these different groups who were in different neighborhoods in Chicago in the late 1960s, how is it that they came together?
It essentially was a coalition of the poor, and basically they're living in very similar conditions, substandard housing, lack of quality education, and really having to deal with a brutal police force. And these sort of commonalities kind of put them in a position where they were willing to try something new. They thought that if they tried a new strategy of working together, perhaps they could make some changes that could improve the quality of life for their community.
One of the groups was the Black Panthers, and they were considered really revolutionary and almost hostile to, white activists, white groups. I mean, how is it that they were able to find commonality with the tell me more about the white group that was that joined up and how they did that?
I think it's still an ongoing misperception of the Black Panthers. And that the news, going back at that time specifically, really portrayed them as being anti-white. But the Black Panther Party always had an internationalist agenda, and they were anti-racist. But the news really focused or tried to project them as being anti-white and that, for whatever reason. And the Young Patriots Organization, which is comprised of Southern Appalachians, that was actually a large community in uptown Chicago. All these folks had migrated, they're looking for work. But because of the deindustrialization of Chicago, a lot of those jobs weren't there anymore. So you have a stream of people coming to Chicago. And once they get there, they realize there is no work for them. And so they're in dire poverty. And also they kind of experienced this hostility from the older populations, the white populations of Chicago, like the Irish, the Polish, the Greek. They did not like the Southern Appalachians. They dressed differently. They spoke differently. So they were kind of going through a sort of, in some ways, an immigrant experience, because there was overt hostility towards that small population. It was maybe 5,000-10,000 people that created their own community. They called it Hillbilly Heaven or Hillbilly Harlem.
And they embraced the Confederate flag as part of their iconography, the Young Patriots. And did that become a problem when they were dealing with the Black Panthers?
It was a problem. I think the leadership kind of were able to look past it because they understood that the Patriots were trying to use it as a sort of a a launching point for discussion for people in their community. But there are a lot of Panthers that didn't, you know, always had an issue with it. And it's my understanding that some of them actually quit the Black Panthers rather than being coalition with the Young Patriots. But I think it was this era of experimentation within the radical groups at the time. I think it was this revolutionary imagination that was trying new strategies, new tactics. And and that was, I think, the genius of the Rainbow Coalition is that, you know, they created this something that hadn't been around before. I mean, there had been coalitions between Blacks and Whites and Chicanos and Native Americans, but this was interesting because it included three groups. It included Southern Whites. And again, as you mentioned, these folks had Confederate flags for a time. And so it really was a possible volatile alliance. And people from the outside thought that. They go, is this going to survive? And I think it could have, but the outside repression began very, very quickly once these groups got together.
Another group, another major group, was the Young Lords, and that was a Puerto Rican street gang, and then they became political when they joined the coalition.
Yeah, it's interesting. The Young Lords is the only movement that I can think of in the history of the United States that came out of a gang and stayed out of a gang. There's been some gangs that have dabbled in politics, but they usually went back to being a gang. The Young Lords were able to create this structure. They ended up having chapters in, I think, over 40 cities in the United States, and it became a major grassroots political movement for the Puerto Rican community for about 15 years. So I think that in itself is significant, and I think the Black Panthers' effect on that movement was tremendous in the sense of, you know, I wouldn't say mentorship, but in terms of trying to bring them up to speed in terms of how to make political change. Fred Hampton, I think that's the... again, one of the geniuses of him. Everyone who talks about Fred Hampton talks about what a great speaker he was, but he was an extraordinary organizer. And I think he was reaching out to people that all of the political parties had essentially forgotten. The Democratic Party, the Republican Party, these folks are not trying to organize gangs. They're not trying to organize the poorest people in Chicago at that time. And Fred Hampton saw a way, saw that these people were ready to be organized. And, you know, he aspired to something much larger than these individual groups that had been before.
So the reason why it seems like it's interesting to watch your documentary film, aside from all the incredible archival footage that you're able to come up with, this coalition, this first Rainbow Coalition, it became a model for future activists. And they were able to point to it as, let's put aside our petty differences and work towards greater goals of beating poverty. And it seems like that was even effective here in San Antonio, where we saw different neighborhoods who at one time were competing for resources, were able to come together under the COPS button and fight for political leverage to bring bigger change.
I think that's a powerful idea when communities make that attempt to work with other communities outside of them. And historically, these communities there's been tension. I know that's true in Chicago, for example, which is one of the most segregated cities in the United States. And so I think that's why the story was so attractive to me, because it was in this milieu that you would have thought that these folks never could have gotten together under the worst possible situation. They were able to form this coalition. And that idea, I think, is such a powerful idea that's why it sort of lingered on, where it's manifested itself over time with other movements. They've embraced this. And it's a really simple idea, but it's really hard to do. You can talk about coalitions, but it's hard work. And it's much easier to divide people. And that's why I think in some of the political rhetoric today, and also the political rhetoric of Mayor Daley back in Chicago at the time, it's easier to divide people because it allows you to maintain your political power. These movements ultimately had formed the political base. And so even though they were outside of that system, the fact that they were across Chicago, they presented a threat to the establishment.
I'm going to play another cut. This is Fred Hampton talking about the importance of solidarity.
Black people and white poor people and red poor people and Puerto Rican poor people and Latin American Puerto Rican people of poor people of all descents, they had them caught up in movements based on racism. When the Black Panther Party stood up and said that we don't care what anybody says, we're going to fight racism, not racism, but we're going to fight with solidarity.
What was it about Fred Hampton that made him the individual, the messiah that many of those in authority were afraid of?
Yeah, Fred Hampton was someone that had been working to form alliances, not just with the, you know, the groups that we know that were in the Rainbow Coalition, but he was actually forming non-aggression pacts with gangs in Chicago, like the Black Pistol Nation. So he was really forming, again, a potential base of activists in the Black Pistol Nation. I don't know if the numbers are 5,000 members. I mean, these are huge, these are large numbers in an urban environment. And we don't go into that into the film because it's complex. But even that, the FBI, for example, was trying to disrupt those efforts. And so he was someone that was looking at organizing, but looking at it in a larger way, trying to include more people rather than just have the Black Panther Party do this. He knew that if he could have this these alliances, the strength of that movement increased, you know, twofold, threefold. And again, being across the city of Chicago, again, it's these resources are spread out. And ultimately, he wanted, you know, the young lords were serving Black kids if they were in the neighborhood. The Black Panthers were serving Latino kids or white kids. So it's interesting. I mean, it's something that is a model. And I think it's something that a lot of young activists who hear about it are inspired by it, because even if this happened today, it still would be a groundbreaking revolutionary movement.
So Fred Hampton, what happened to him?
Well, you know, we see the FBI documents that there's a series of photographs when there was a press conference that all the groups are together. 10 days after that, the FBI requests to do counterintelligence operations against the Rainbow Coalition, and they do. So the FBI, in conjunction with the Red Squad, which is an offshoot of the Chicago Police Force, basically we're trying to disrupt these movements, either by just arresting people randomly, surveilling them, pulling them over, taking their telephone books and copying all of their information and all their contacts, finding their license plates when they had meetings. So there was overt harassment. And ultimately, and it's a pretty well-known case where the Chicago police raided Fred Hampton's apartment. And there was the Chicago police said there was a shootout where Fred Hampton's killed, another Black Panther named Mark Clark is killed. But ultimately, when they went back and looked at the shell casings and the bullet trajectories, the Black Panthers only fired one bullet, and that was when Mark Clark was killed. He just automatically shot his rifle into the ceiling. There was no shootout. It was all a large fabricated event. And ultimately, the Hampton family was awarded a very large payout. Years later, the largest payout in the history of Chicago for the death of Fred Hampton.
Here's a cut from Jack Ryan, a former FBI agent, talking about the counterintelligence program spying on these activists.
Counterintelligence program, it was spying on groups to disrupt forces that we found objectionable. That's what we did. The good word is neutralize. Black Panthers, you know, all these groups, they were the enemy. There was a mindset, we were gonna lose the country. You know, it's us versus them. And we worked with the police, but we all generally thought the same way.
So Ray, it seemed like the police were very much aware that this is a political organization that was threatening the status quo.
And that's it. You know, and when you look at, for example, Jack Ryan's, and even there's another police officer, there's a police officer, Howard Saffold, who appears in the documentary. The police made it personal. The FBI made it personal. They went beyond their role as enforcing law enforcement into harassment, into personal vendetta, based on the politics of these groups. And when you cross that line, I mean, where does it end? I mean, if you are attacking groups just because you don't agree with their politics, I think that's the larger issue and why this FBI surveillance is so dangerous in a democratic society, is that if people don't have the ability to talk and discuss ideas and enact change to improve their communities, then the whole system is how does any change happen? And again, they went after these groups for, I think there was a race issue involved, in court, of course. But I think it's a dangerous thing. And that's what we did go back and try to include these voices. We wanted people to know what the mindset was of the FBI and the Chicago police, and how it really was far beyond any kind of role they're supposed to play in society. It was, again, a personal vendetta against these groups because of their politics.
The death of Fred Hampton, did that basically kind of end this Rainbow Coalition?
It essentially did. I mean, these movements continued on for years. The Black Panther Party in Chicago continued on for years, but the growth that these movements were involved in, that ended. There was no more growth. It was more defensive, and they shrunk. The Young Lords, for example, the leadership went underground almost immediately for 2 years. They just essentially, you know, were hiding out. Nobody knew where they were because everyone was afraid they would be targeted for death as well. Essentially, I mean, you can call it an assassination squad. If it's planned and everyone, the police knows about it, it inspired fear in all the leadership of these groups because they thought they were next. And so it essentially killed the momentum of that movement. And it was never able to recover their status or their size.
Part of the the incredibleness of your documentary is the archival footage that you have. How did you come up with all that?
Well, you know, I was working on this film for about 14 years, but I was really actually gathering material as far back to 1992. So the good thing about working on something for so long is you have a lot more time to find things. I have my own personal film archive that I've gathered over the last 10 years. So I was looking for this material, like Chicago, this unusual shot of Chicago trains. I found these shots of Cha-Cha Mendes getting arrested at age 16. I bought them off of eBay. And so, you know, there's stuff out there that's not in archives that you can purchase, and then you can find the rights owners afterwards. And so that's what I did. I found some incredible footage that is not in archives, or if it's in archives, it's not indexed properly. So they have it, but they don't know they have it. So I had to basically tell them, I know you have this film. Can you look for it? And that's what we did for some of it. And that was one of the goals. We didn't want the film to look like other films that had been done about Chicago. We wanted to have a sort of a texture to it. We wanted to have a grittiness to it. And we wanted to transport audiences there so they can get a sense of sort of what a difficult situation these groups are in dire poverty with very limited resources. But we're able to start these Breakfast for Children's programs, daycare centers for kids, free health clinics. With very little resources, these groups are able to do a lot. And again, it's such an example. I mean, we're still trying to get quality health care in this country. So anyway, I think it's an inspiring story. And that's one of the reasons why I spent so much time working on it.
How much has been remembered in Chicago? Is it a legendary sort of experience, the first Rainbow Coalition? Or was this something that you kind of had to pluck from the mist of almost forgotten history?
I think in Chicago, there is an awareness of it within activists at that time. The more outside of Chicago, even people who were activists knew a little bit about it. It's a retrieval of this history. There is no book about this this history. There have been chapters and books about it, but there is no sort of comprehensive approach to the origins and the legacy of that Rainbow Coalition. We know, for example, I mean, the death of Fred Hampton is such an open wound in the Black community because he's one of the best. He's one of the brightest, killed, you know, at such a young age, age 21. And so, I mean, that memory is you know, people are still coming to terms with that. And so that was one of the things that I think was important is people need to remember what Fred Hampton was trying to do. And again, we're in a very divisive time in this country. And so that idea of the Rainbow Coalition, solidarity and alliances and working outside of your own community to make change, I think, is an important idea to put back in society again.
So your film is airing on PBS, on Independent Lens, and how else will people be able to experience it?
Well, it'll be after the broadcast, it'll be available for streaming for about 30 days afterwards at the Independent Lens website. And after that, we have a educational distributor, GoodDocs, that will be trying to get the film into colleges and schools and libraries and that kind of thing. We haven't quite breached the thing where we're going to make individual copies, but that's coming right around the corner. We just finished the film October 15th, so it's really been just kind of a very, very fast sort of trajectory in terms of trying to get the film out, trying to get the film on Independent Lens. But we're going to just pivot after the broadcast and start focusing on the distribution of the film.
Okay, Ray Santisteban, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it. And the film was great. I enjoyed it. And I look forward to seeing you around town.
Thank you. Thank you, David.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by me, Ruben Garcia. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.